Welcome, book lovers, to another Adapted, where we talk about books that have been turned into movies, and today we're talking about Neil Gaiman's Stardust, so stay tuned.
This is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we are indeed book lovers. Book lover Marissa Serafini, welcome to the show.
Hello, Phil. We are here once again.
That's right. Our library is filling up.
Yes, it is.
Pun intended.
I really enjoyed this one.
I enjoyed this too. I saw... So a couple of things before we even get started.
Yes.
Of course, you can get our rundown in the description box, so that way it has all the various things. And hopefully without saying, it's going to be spoiler-filled.
Yes.
Both for the book and both for the movie. There's, of course, going to be differences we're just going to talk about. And therefore, you've been warned. Now, we've done books that have been turned into many films, which, in fact, the next... I'll tease it now. Usually we save it to the end, but mm-hmm. I'll tease it now. The next book that we're going to do is Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which has been turned into so many different things. And one of the reasons I wanted to do that one was because I don't feel many people know the actual source material.
Yeah.
But we digress. Overall thoughts for Stardust.
Well, I originally saw the movie when it first came out in theaters. Loved it.
2007.
2007, yes. I was in high school, just saying. And I really enjoyed it. Fantasy and drama and romance. It has all my favorite genres all in one movie. And then knowing after the fact that it was written by the book, I always wanted to read the book, but somehow never got around to it. And then I'm glad for this show that you chose this book to read, and I got really excited because I loved the film. And when it came out on DVD, I bought it that day that it got released. Like, I really enjoyed the film because I thought it was so good, and I was really excited to read this book. And I'm glad that the book was just as enjoyable as the film. And sometimes we like the book more than the other, or conversely. And I enjoyed both. I really enjoyed the fantasy, the characters. I liked the writing style, and we'll definitely get into it. But overall, I really enjoyed it, and I can't wait to talk about it.
Neil Gaiman, for me, is a very visual author, and so it translates really well. Now, for this, I actually saw the movie first, and like you, it was a breath of fresh air. It really was, because it had all... It took things, but it never went too cheesy, mm-hmm. and it had the right fantasy, and the characters were very well crafted, and of course Robert De Niro as the pirate captain
Shakespeare
just took it out of nowhere and was amazing. Michelle Pfeiffer, of course, as the witch and so forth. Like, all these characters just came to life in such a beautiful way, and therefore I wanted to read the book. And I was quite captivated. You know, for me, I think he translates extremely well, whether it's Coraline, American Gods now is being done as a TV series. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see more of his work turned into whether TV series or movies. And in particular, the Graveyard book, because that's... We did the Jungle Book. It's kind of like his version of Jungle Book, and I think it's fun. And one of the things that I didn't realize until now is the fact that him and I share a birthday.
Oh, November 10th. Do you really?
November 10th. Me and Neil Gaiman.
Birthday buddies.
That's right. So, you know, he holds that in my heart.
Very neat. So you definitely have that in common with each other. I love when that happens. I really loved the style of writing because this particular one, I mean, I felt when I was reading, it felt like a young adult novel, but it's more of an adult type of fantasy book. But then watching the movie, that was more a young adult style, just in storytelling and narrative. But I enjoy it because I think his writing is so broad and it can touch on like multiple demographics that anyone at any age could really enjoy his writing.
That was his intent with this book, was to write... He, you know, we'll talk about his inspirations, but, you know, taking those inspirations, he really wanted to write a fantasy novel for adults. And in fact, the version I have, in fact, says a fantasy novel for adults. You know, and when we talk about the adaptation of it, they changed that very sexualized part of the book and made it more whimsical in the movie. There's definitely a lot of sexual things going on in the book.
There is, and in the movie, it's way more PG, PG-13. But I don't feel like they went over the top, and it not any time during the book it felt ever gratuitous. You definitely understood what was happening, but then it didn't linger on too long, and it just moved forward really fast. So.
And what I appreciate about it, he's an English author, so the story takes place in England. So he's utilizing his knowledge of these things, and I love his sense of magical realism. You know, there's a town, and just over the wall, there's mm-hmm. another town and another world, and it's got unicorns, it's got witches, it's got wizards.
It has magic and the dark elements too. I like that because he so easily blends the realistic with the fantasy, such as, you know, the real town that anyone can grow up in and is really familiar with. And then you cross the wall, this border, and you're in literally in another land with different types of people and personalities and just elements of that defy regular human nature. And I think it's fantastic because they all blend together so well.
Yeah. One of the things, I don't know how much Gaiman you've read, is that ability to keep it almost matter of fact, like it just is. You know, in particular for me, Coraline has that sense of duality. In fact, that is two worlds, and that doesn't spoil anything. Neverwhere is also a version of that, where the sewers are their own completely different world of London, in particular in that book. So he's able to craft that, and it seems to be a motif in a lot of his writing.
I like that. And this actually is my first Neil Gaiman book, and I've known about his writing. I just never really got around to reading him until this book. But I liked it so much that I want to read his other ones, especially, you know, learning that he tends to write different worlds in his books is definitely appealing to me as a reader.
And he has a fascination with fantasy, right? It's known, whether it be Tolkien, whether it be C.S. Lewis, even to the more moderns. Well, I guess those technically would count as modern, but Ursula Le Guin.
And Edgar Allan Poe, and who's a famous author, and who also has that dark fantasy type of writing style as well.
And Gaiman in particular, like, one of the things he's absolutely fascinated with is Norse mythology. And so he a lot of his fantasy elements sort of come from there as well, in terms of what's possible. In fact, he has a new book out called Norse Mythology.
Oh, excellent. Maybe we should read that next. But that's not adapted into anything.
Not yet.
But that sounds amazing. And I think he does a great job of setting up different worlds within one big universe. And everyone just exist and coexist with each other quite well. I love it.
So we're dancing around these worlds, but let's talk about the world of Stardust.
Yes.
When we enter into it, it's fairly easily explained. You know, and for me, the tough part, I would be very curious for those of you watching or listening, did you watch the movie first or did you read the book first? Because, you know, for us, we've seen the movie, therefore we're going to go into it with a certain understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps in that sense, I was able to visualize it because literally I had already seen the visualization of it.
Right, right. I think the great thing about this book, because there are really like three main storylines that are going on. We have Tristan and Yvain, and then we had the nameless witch in the book, and then we also had Septimus and the rise to power that he's trying to find. So we had like three different storylines. And I like how the book easily sets up in the first 50 pages, sets up Tristan's story and how he was conceived and how he was born. And then we get into the witch. And then we get into the Septimus. And it does an easy job of establishing who's who and their stories and their backgrounds. And then once we have the three different establishments, then they blend together at the same time simultaneously, which I enjoyed.
I was very surprised that it was only 10 chapters overall, but each of the chapters, one of the things I really can appreciate about Neil Gaiman is the fact that his stories move. He knows when to pause and give a little bit of description. Like, the fact that he didn't really describe... He doesn't spend pages upon pages describing anything. Mm-hmm. And yet you can visualize this world is fantastic to me, because I've read other authors that spend pages upon pages, and I'm still like, I have no idea what the hell this place is.
Right. Which our next author... It takes a lot of time in detailing one particular thing. I agree. When I was reading this, at the end of the book, I consciously thought, I was like, wow, never once was I bored. I think there was great pacing in the book. It didn't spend too much time on one thing. We were constantly moving. The characters were constantly moving and traveling, therefore naturally progressing the narrative forward. It never was bored or slow or tiring at any moment. And I think there was always like a kinetic movement to everybody.
Absolutely. And though they had their various different motives, overall, and maybe just how whimsically it was written, no one to me at the end of the day seemed that evil. Even at the end, when the star kisses the unnamed wish, she feels bad for her, and that's what she does. She kisses her. Versus, I mean, she's been trying to take your heart,
right? And that's what I also enjoyed about the book, because having watched the movie, that does a great job of it. Setting up an antagonist to our protagonist. The witch is the main antagonist. And then in the book, the witch was like someone who had a dark motive, but even at the end was still on some level very human. And having Yvain like feel for her and have empathy and some sympathy and giving her a kiss on the forehead, like even at the end, the witch was like, okay, I was still happy for Yvain too, that she found her happiness. And the witch was like, okay, I didn't get what I wanted. I'm just going to move forward in my life.
I mean, in a crazy way, it's kind of insane to think that he's basically taking all these elements. You mentioned the three storylines paralleling each other, and then they converge into one. Each of these, in essence, like if you were an author setting out to write a book, could be their own storyline, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what he does so masterfully is that he takes each of those elements and is just able to combine them in a way that's not convoluted or trying to think of the other C word.
Confusing.
Confusing. Contrived, maybe.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
I agree. And I think, you know, some writers are really great at doing that. But that's also a testament to his writing of good establishment of characters. We clearly know who's who. It's spending the 50 pages on Tristran in the book, and then spending another like 20 on Septimus. He does a good job of showing who's who, what the motives is, and how they play into the part when they finally meet each other.
And one of the things that really works is the fact that the motive very early on is identified as the same. Because mm-hmm. there's often books you meet a lot of characters, and in particular I can think of William Gibson kind of does this, where you meet various characters and yes, their storylines are converging, but it's like you don't really know that. Whereas right off the bat, you know everyone's goal is get that star.
Right. And what I liked about Septimus' storyline is it wasn't really after the person. It was just what she had in her possession, and which he didn't really know. He's just trying to find the pendant to fill and gain his reign on the throne. And I liked how he didn't really have a dark motive. It was just something for his own personal selfish reason. But it wasn't really towards anyone else. I mean, killing his brothers, yes, that's dark.
I was going to say, like, yeah, you gotta...
It was dark, but how they treated it didn't seem like over-the-top murder, yeah.
Well, luckily he didn't murder his brother Primus.
Yes.
But he did have to avenge his death, and the interesting part was the way the book told it, it made Septimus ultimately look like an incompetent fool. Like the witches were just so much more craftier than any of us.
Mm-hmm. I like the witches. The witches, I think, had a good role in the book and also in the film, which we'll definitely get to. I think they did a great job of showing these characters. They had like a small part, but yet it was very pivotal in the whole thing.
And what was so interesting to me, you know, this novel came out in 1998, so it was not too much between the novel and the book, but still enough time. And what I appreciated was the fact that they took the spirit of this book and really expanded upon it. That's what I want a movie to do. I don't need it to be 100% faithful to it, but take the spirit and expand upon it and take it from there. And that's what the movie for me certainly did, and that's why it was the breath of fresh air when it first came out.
Right, and that's why I also liked the movie, because I felt like they added actual more fantasy elements with that creative license that they had. And they built different characters up more, and we'll definitely get into that. But not once did it take away from the characters and who they are and their true selves. But it added more to the fantasy world and the things and the people and the situations that they were in, just added more magic, which helps with an adventurous story.
Yeah, and the thing, what I loved about the movie, and you know, talking similarities, they took that pace of the book, that rapid pace, and visualized it. You're always seeing stage coaches, you're always seeing people moving, running, and so forth, and whatnot. And I appreciated that. One of the biggest differences to me, I know you might disagree, and people at home might disagree, but was the fact of giving it a deadline. You know, in the movie, he has a deadline, like before the birthday, he has to get back.
Yeah.
Right? And in the book, it's like, just go off on an adventure and find the star.
Yeah, and that's what I was surprised, having watched the movie several times. It seemed like all this whole adventure that they were on only took maybe 1 or 2 weeks, like a really short amount of time in real time. And then the book, it seemed like it took years for him to go on this adventure and then return.
One of my favorite, I definitely had a double take moment, because I was, you know, when they first get sort of dropped off post the cloud ship scene, they're like, all right, well, it'll still be another 8 weeks, but we got you close enough. I was like, 8 weeks? Close enough?
Right. And they're walking, they see the stone, and it said 60 miles to the village of the wall, and they're like, oh, it'll take maybe a day. Like, okay, so the time limit of how they're traveling didn't seem like there was any limits, but in the movie, obviously, you have to have a whole book condensed into 2 hours, and it felt like that, but that helps with the pace that everybody was still traveling at a rapid pace, literally. Where in the book, it's like, I think it had a harder time, or not really a harder time, but just it was less descriptive of how long it took everybody to get where they were going. Yeah.
Well, I'm pleased with that, because though Tolkien was his inspiration, Tolkien definitely has a way of just, he's great with language, but nonetheless, it's the hobbits walked, and then they walked, and then they walked over a mountain, and then they walked over a river, and then they picked up some water to drink at the river. I didn't need that. Like, just keep the story going.
Right. And we've talked about another book, The Revenant, where, you know, the main character had to walk and travel over a course of months, and just him healing and stuff. So, like, we've definitely had our fair share of authors who spend a lot of time and it's very descriptive of how much time it takes to get to somewhere, but I'm glad it wasn't as descriptive in this book, because that just allows you to get lost in what they're doing, not how long it's taking.
Exactly. So let's talk about the development of this movie. Originally, Miramax had the rights, but overall, Neil Gaiman felt that it wasn't a right fit. Creatively, they didn't understand it, and so forth. And then Terry Gilliam and Matthew Vaughn kind of stepped into the picture. Time went on, only because Vaughn was doing some other stuff, whether it be Layer Cake, X-Men, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in a way, was good, though, because it allowed them the time to really think about it. And then, you know, finally, Matthew Vaughn was able to direct the movie.
Yeah, and I'm glad he got on board and helped, and Paramount helped with the distribution ultimately at the end of the film. But Gaiman and Vaughn, you know, they started their collaboration, and it was actually Gaiman who introduced Vaughn to the screenwriter Jane Goldman, and that's how Jane Goldman got on board with the whole screenwriting and screen adapting from the book to film. And then from there, that's where it all just finally the ball started rolling.
And rolling it did. I'm just, I know we'll talk about this. I guess let's talk about it now, only because I really applaud the actors who portrayed the characters. I think they got casting 100% right. And not that you needed big names in those roles to do it right, mm-hmm. but I just enjoyed everyone's level to commit to it and the passion with which they did it.
Yeah, and I think that's the great thing about these characters. They are fantasy, so you can expand upon, you know, drama and realism, especially when it came to Robert De Niro, a very well-established Academy Award winner, but playing a fluffy captain in this type of role, you think someone who's as well-established as Robert De Niro, but playing something as ridiculous as this character, it definitely shows that these characters were for fun and for the passion of just acting and being in a film. And it's not once did a dent on his career whatsoever. And even Michelle Pfeiffer. I love Michelle Pfeiffer, just her as an actress. And she played the evil witch to such great extent. I loved watching her. She was gorgeous, like following and everything that she was doing. But yes, she's so good at being evil at the same time. She was great. And I really can't picture anyone else doing this role.
No, she did such an amazing job with her bitchiness, if you will. Hey, because the amazing part is, and not in a conceited way, although perhaps for the witch it was, she knows how gorgeous she could be, right? but because she doesn't have the star's heart, it's irking on her. And what I love is the visualization of it, like whether it's her, you know, skin a little bit falling and so forth. She's just annoyed by it because she knows her true, well, at least outward beauty, you know, whether she's has actual true beauty, internal beauty, mm-hmm. remains to be debated. But yeah, 100% loved it.
I love Michelle Pfeiffer, and she's gorgeous in and of herself too. And I liked how there are some actors who are like big names, but are really concerned about their looks. And Michelle Pfeiffer, this character is heavy makeup, and she went in balls to the wall, and like understand that this is an old witch who is physically deteriorating because she doesn't have magic, and she just went for it, and she doesn't care anything about the looks. It was just for like the pure talent and having an awesome character on screen.
Absolutely. And of course, for me, Claire Danes as the star, literally, figuratively.
Literally.
Fantastic job. I thought worked well with, especially next to Charlie Cox.
Yeah, you know, admittedly, I've watched Claire Danes over the years, just growing up as a teenager and stuff. And when I first watched the movie, I was taken aback by Claire Danes' accent, only because I know she's American. She doesn't have a British accent. So it took me like 5 minutes to, like, okay, she's British. Moving forward, it wasn't bad. I think she did a great job of being kind of irritated towards Tristan, which understandably so, in her given her situation, she just fell from the sky. She's gonna be impatient, but she warmed up too because she's great at drama and romance. That's what she's good as an actor for. So it was very realistic.
Yeah, that was the thing too. You know, when you speak about her annoyance with Tristan, I thought she 100% nailed that. And if there's anything that they 100% got right in terms of what the book represented and movie-wise what they were able to show, was the star's true journey in terms of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such a fantastic idea. A star falls down and, oh, it's not like... even as Tristan says in the book and the movie, like, oh, you're not just this ball of whatever.
Yes.
You're a woman. Oh, you're the star. You're the star.
I love that delivery.
And she has this annoyance of like, wait, I have to come with you? Like, you think I'm a piece of property? And yeah, she just warms up, and of course that happens in the book as well. And true to the form, they got it 100% right.
Right, and I like it. Also in the book and the movie, they did a good job of showing Yvain's progression from, like, a star is, you're not really thinking of it as a human being, but being transformed into a human, it slowly showed her personality and her humanistic qualities. Where in the movie, there's a whole scene where she's finally, you know, professing her love to Tristan, and she starts to finally understand humans and what they do and the crazy things that they do when they're in love, and she understands what humans are going through because she's going through it. And I thought that was very realistic, and I enjoyed it.
What I appreciated about the movie version is they took that concept and expanded upon that idea, because in the book they don't really talk about it. Where, yeah, as a star, you sort of look down on the earth and you observe it. Mm-hmm. But you're right. In this sense, in the movie, they were literally able to take her, and now she's being like, okay, well, basically, she's made that connection of like, wow, I didn't really, even though I observed, I haven't really learned.
Mm-hmm. She didn't know because she never experienced it. It's one thing to look upon. It's another thing to actually live it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a great portrayal and just a realistic thing that people go through once they realize that moment, like, oh, this is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. And it was so innocent, too. And I think in the movie they did a great job of balancing, like, what could have been a really serious / cheesy profession of love, but it was also nicely mixed with comedy because he is a mouse in mm-hmm. the form of, so he's not really, like, hearing it from person to person. It was person to mouse. It was light, but light enough to take seriously, so...
Let's talk about Sienna Miller, because her as Victoria Forrester, I thought if there's any change that they made her, in a good way in the movie, less desirable.
Yeah.
I mean, not physically, Sienna Miller, gorgeous, mm-hmm. but just her attitude, it was all beauty and no substance whatsoever.
Right, personality. And I think they did a good job in the movie because it clearly establishes, like, oh, what is Tristan doing agreeing to do this for this horrible woman who clearly does not belong with her, or she doesn't belong to him. And I like that because they did a good job of showing that she's not the right girl and he will eventually fall in love with someone else, which is Yvain, who's obviously the better choice. And I like that because in the book, Tristan's is like so obsessed with her, really. It's like Victoria this, Victoria that. But then Victoria literally goes away. But then when he comes back to talk to her, even she had like a very understandably, you know, like an... understood his situation and like actually felt bad, like, I know you made this promise to me and you set off and did this for me and I feel bad that I did this instead. Like she was very understanding the whole situation. You don't
understanding and guilt ridden.
Yeah.
One of the more painful lines was the fact of I didn't know which was better for you to come back and for like, or essentially she says, I didn't know what was worse for you to come back and me have to marry you or for you never come back and therefore be dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh damn.
Yeah.
That's compassion. I mean, it's not great that that's your line of thinking, but to understand that, wow, that's something's wrong on that.
Right. And she was also torn. It was like, is someone else is waiting for me as well, but I was waiting for you. And so she had that realistic storyline too, just as a person who actually had a conscience, where this Victoria in the movie really didn't care about anything. She was more shallow in the movie.
Yes. Which is unfortunate, I guess, for women, especially in today's day and age.
Yeah, it was not a great portrayal for this particular character.
Yeah. But worked nonetheless.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about other changes, because certainly as far as like the climax of the book goes, it just kind of happened and it didn't you know, that we got to more important things, if you will, which was emotional beats rather than action, whereas in the movie we got tons of action.
A lot of action, which I enjoyed in both. Let's talk about the book first, because I felt the book was way more expository with Lady Una. I felt she had a way bigger role in the book, because she's the one who's explaining everything to everybody. And I believe she meets everybody. It's like there's a scene where she's like with Septimus, with Victoria with the witch, like, and she's the one explaining, like, oh no, Tristan, you're the last son, and it's like she's giving all the exposition to everybody, which I didn't expect because of her character being a slave and in bird form. You wouldn't think it'd be from this person that you physically really never saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't think about it in that sense either. Mainly perhaps just because I was so thrown off by the end where Tristan and her are fighting over how long they're going to take to get back.
Yeah. But I enjoyed it because I really enjoyed that it was like Lady Una, because after all the slavery that she unfortunately had to go through, at the end, she was the one who actually became, you know, queen of everything, and she had her regency before Tristan ever did, because in the movie he just immediately got the seat and the mother was just there. But so I like that, I found that actually very realistic, that she would come back to power. Mm-hmm. And then Tristan would come in when it was his time.
It gave her, yeah, it's a lot more poetic, certainly, because it gives her importance. Like, she's not just, her importance is not having birth the next heir. Mm-hmm. She runs the thing. So, yeah, 100%. I guess we can say Neil Gaiman is good to women.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're learning.
I will read more of his books if he establishes more strong women. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Coraline, even though she's a child, she's a...
She's a strong protagonist, yes. Agreed.
Anyway, but just in general, too, like, when Septimus... Like, that whole encounter in the book... He's going to Diggory's Dig, right? That's the name of it, I believe. And that's where, you know, everyone has to cross through here, and then they'll get to Wall. With that, he's essentially just avenging Primus, because he's like, okay, I'm gonna be the next in line, and I'm gonna burn this house down. And if for some reason they survive it, I'll club them to death. And the way perspires, very comedic.
What a good brother.
But just the fact, like I said, it's just very simplified versus in the movie. I mean, we get left and right magic and so forth.
He's part of the whole third act trying to kill Tristan too. I liked his character more in the movie, admittedly, like, so, because I felt in the book, when it got to the whole house bit, and I felt like Septimus' story just kind of ended once Luna explained that Tristan is actually the last blood heir, and Septimus literally just kind of went away, and I felt his storyline just abruptly ended, and we never saw him actually ever again. Where in the book... we were in the movie, he had like a full arc in a way, and even ended comedically too, with the, you know, whole voodoo doll fighting, and then also just physically non-corporeally with his brothers in the ghost. So there's a lot of comedic elements to his character too. As serious, and I think Mark Strong is such a good, strong actor. We've talked about him a lot in our movie discussions. He's such a good actor, and to also play comedy as well with fantasy, he did a great job.
Absolutely, and I really appreciated in the movie that they really ran with all the dead brothers. Because you're right, in that sense, it became a missing component of it, whereas in the movie they were ever-present, even if just visually. You know, then that's what sort of makes it easy. They use the tools that they had available to them, which is the frame, mm-hmm. and just put them there.
Yeah, I love the brothers in the movie, because I think they were obviously the comic beats in the movies, especially when, you know, one's being the creeper looking in on them making out, and they're like, pervert, you know, all that. Like, there's just good moments where the brothers were inserted when they... Like, especially the moment where I remember when I first watched this movie, I laughed out loud because I think it was just such good timing, was when Septimus and Una first saw each other again, and then all the brothers were like, sister, you're here. Like, they were just inserted so well into comedic jokes. And even in the book, it's kind of, I don't want to say weird, but they're just there. You're reading, like, five gray guys are also in the room, but then when Tristan looks back, they're gone. You're like, okay, they're just beings that are there, and we just have to accept it as authors, or as readers. But in the movie, they're there for a comedic element.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And so we talked about a little bit about Lady Una, but also let's talk about her captor, right? Because in the book, I really liked it. You know, all the various, especially what I appreciate about the movie is that overall the beats, certainly in the beginning, to me, they kept the beginning and the middle very
similar.
And then the ending is what primarily changed.
Yeah.
But, you know, the captor, you know, she's
Ditchwater Cell in the movie. And in the book, it's Madame Semele.
Yes. What was the truth stuff that she had?
Limbus grass.
That's right. You gave me limbus grass.
How dare you steal truth from my list by feeding me limbus grass? Yeah, so good.
I thought the curse worked really well in both the movie and the book as far as not being able to see the star.
Yeah, it definitely visually, I think they did a great job in the movie. They visually explain why Yvain couldn't talk to Ditchwater Cell, or, you know, the other way around. Because in the book, you can easily misread that, or, like, not fully understand it. Because they did have the same moment when Yvain's trying to talk to her, and she's obviously ignoring her. I think visually, that's where, like, the filmic elements in adaptation, like, really helps just with the storytelling. Like, oh, yeah, she put a curse on her. She can't see her.
I thought he did, to me, he did a good enough job doing it, because he was able to tell it from both perspectives. He's seeing it from Tristan's perspective, but then he also switches into her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, it worked for me.
Yeah, it's an easily blended narrative, and I think that's what's good, because it was all third person, but he has every voice is easy to understand. That's why we can switch from person to person so fluidly.
Yeah, and some people don't have that ability, though.
No.
So Neil definitely does. As far as why adapt this movie, or why adapt this book into a movie, well, to me, it has all the tropes that you would want to see in fantasy, and it just really honors them in a fun way. There's definitely an emotional component to it, but it doesn't take it ever self, like, too self-righteous. Like, this is not, no offense to Lord of the Rings, this is not Lord of the Rings. We're not, like, saving Mordor here.
Yeah.
We're just going to get a star.
Yeah, and the great thing is everyone also had their own different motives. It wasn't really towards other people. It's just, like, their own self-purpose in life. I enjoy that because, again, with the three different stories, it could get really confusing, but it never was. And for the filmic elements, you have multiple different things in this that can appeal to a huge, wide audience. You have a romantic story. You have an adventure story. You have magic. So you already have a fantasy story. And just the characters. You have an old woman. You have old man, you have a younger I want to say like 20-30 year olds. Like, there are different age and demographics in this book too, where it appeals to a lot of different people just in the world as you're reading. So it has a wide audience that could enjoy the story in and of itself, that could also translate to the film.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I appreciated was the language of the book in general, because, you know, much like Tolkien, like, you know, one of the things that does scare me is that you're going to read another Neil Gaiman book and be like, ooh, this is completely different. Because he used purposeful language within the storytelling of this, I think, brilliantly. But to me, Gaiman is actually kind of somewhat of a chameleon. Like, his style is the ability to adapt to whatever genre he's trying out versus other writers like Nicholas
Sparks only does romance. You know, I can't imagine him doing like a thriller mystery, you know?
But even so, like, just in that same vein, you know, like, you know, the way he describes certain things, like, I'm sure even though it's romance, it's not like he uses different language just because he wants to try something within that. Like, he wants to try a modern romance versus like an 18th century, and all of a sudden, you know, so Gaiman, the language becomes part of the art.
Yeah, and I think he does it so well because he's very descriptive, but not, but it's not like in a weird written, like Shakespeare writes, tends to write in iambic pentameter. There's a rhythm to his writing. And Neil Gaiman is just like so descriptive, but so easy and understanding and comprehensive.
100%. And you know what I love about it is it has that whimsical side of a true fairy tale for kids, but it's for adults.
Yeah. And when I was reading it, I thought it was a young adult because I was breezing right through it. I was like, oh, this is great.
Any other observations about the book and or movie that you want to talk about before we...
Can we talk a little bit more about Captain Shakespeare?
Sure.
Because even in the book, obviously Captain... Like, they dealt with the pirates for only a short amount of time. Maybe a couple pages, and that was it. And we even got the name, the ship Perdita. But, like, we didn't even really get... the pirates' names, not everyone on board. But I loved in the movie, because we did have Robert De Niro, we do have a face to the character. I'm glad that they actually gave him a fun, more bigger character. And, like, he does a great job of being, like, serious to, and he can have that authoritative leadership that people can believe that he's a captain of a ship, but also can have fun while dressing up and, like, dancing around like a fool. That's also fun too. And was it necessary? No. Was it fun? Absolutely.
Well, two things I'll say on that. One, the fact that his crew, because it was obviously his worry that his crew wouldn't respect him, but the fact that nonetheless they did, that went against convention, and I appreciated that. Secondly, you know, while they're on the ship, there's a purpose to it. They're learning things. And so they took advantage of that moment. Like I said, like we've said, they expanded. The book overall is a very fun, almost outline for what the movie became. Mm-hmm. And they took this moment. Oh, we have this idea. Great. Let's expand upon that.
Yeah. And we have Robert De Niro. Let's give him more to do.
And that's why I think he took it. It's just he saw it. He's like, all right, I'm in. This is fun.
Yeah. And even, and I think this is where talking about how storylines mesh with each other so well. Even Captain Shakespeare met up with Septimus, or more so Septimus guys, like, raided his ship. But, like, that literally crashing of storylines, but still moves the plot forward because Shakespeare helped get Tristan and Yvonne to this certain checkpoint in the story, and that's where they met up with Septimus, you know? That's, like, how people come to the exact same moment.
Absolutely.
Brilliantly done.
Indeed. I think... Say what you will about Raging Bull, this might be Robert De Niro's finest work.
Definitely most memorable. One of his most memorable characters.
All right. Anything else? Any other things you absolutely adored?
I liked, actually, in the movie, how we did have a narrator. Like in
Ian McKellen.
Ian McKellen, also brilliant, brilliant actor, Shakespearean actor himself, too. And in the book, I think did a great job of establishing the lands. This is the wall. This is London. This is X, Y, and Z. And he started it, and he ended the film, too. And was it needed? I think so, actually, in the movie.
What I'll say about that, I think it was needed, but from the perspective that it just made it fun, right? I think if they really wanted to, they could have told the story without narration. Mm-hmm. And that to me says, because what I hate is when people use narration as a crutch. Yeah. This was like, okay, we're going into fairy tales. We're going to have a lot of fun with it. And you're used to having a narrator. It's no different than like the Princess Bride, you know, the grandfather's reading to the kid.
Right.
So in that same vein, we want to give you this level of comfort. Not because we need to. We're more creative than that. If we wanted to like explain the rules of this, we could. But it's more fun.
Yeah. And I think the ending of this book with the narration, too, also visually showed that they had a more romantic type of ending that I definitely feels with that every movie has to end happy. Not really, but like this movie definitely had a happier ending where both Yvain and Tristan, they lived their long lives together, happy in the kingdom, and then they ended up literally among the stars together. That's a romantic ending. Where in the book, unfortunately, Tristan dies just thanks to human old age, and Yvain takes the throne, and they end up technically separated. And that's not as sad and as, or that's a sadder, more unsatisfactory type of ending.
Indeed. Yeah, that's true.
But in the movie, they ended it happy.
They did. They lived happily ever after. And so will you.
Hopefully all of us, yes.
Indeed. All right. Well, thank you guys, as always, for joining us. Keep commenting. Let us know what you thought of the book, the movie. And also, we're open to recommendations. Obviously, we've got our next one, but we don't have anything solidified after that. So, by all means.
Yeah.
So, we'll be doing A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, obviously adapted into TV shows, movies. There's so much to talk about.
Multiple iterations.
In particular, if there's a specific adaptation you want to 100% us to touch upon, for me, I'm a fan of the Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah, I was going to say the Muppets. So, everyone loves the Muppets.
Anyway, thank you guys as always. Truly appreciate it. And in the meantime, where can people interact with you?
Everyone can follow me on Twitter and all those fun places at SerafiniTV.
That's right, and I'm at Phil Svitek, and of course, me and Marissa also do another show called Anatomy of Movie. It's over on popcorntalk.com. Check it out. We do pretty much this, but for movies, and we break down the production side of things, the development side of things, the acting, and everything in between, down to even the numbers, how much money it made, and how its reception was. Anyway, thank you for joining us yet again. We'll see you guys next time on another Book Circle adapted show.
From executive producers Kevin Undergaro, Maria Menounos, and Jeffrey Masters, thanks for tuning in to Book Circle Online. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a comment. To suggest a book title or their author, you can tweet us at Book Circle On. This is Book Circle Online. Thanks for tuning in.